We have some fun with looking at marriage because in the world there is such a misconception of what God intended for marriage and an overreaction to that. And oftentimes you hear it in the media and the news, you know, about marriage being 50-50. When it comes down to looking at how God intended marriage, we get some great insight in this. But I want you to get the context before we jump right into it. If you read the Bible and you take things out of context, then sometimes you miss things or you'll add your own ideas and thoughts. The context of what Peter is saying at this point in his letter is he's encouraging people that are suffering a great deal of persecution. He's encouraging those in unjust situations to endure it patiently and encouraging them to follow Jesus' example, who was unjustly killed, and yet he allowed himself. He was like a lamb led to the slaughter. He suffered, but he did not threaten. He committed himself to him who judges righteously. He committed himself unto God, even though it was unjust. And in that sense, he bore our sin. That's why he died. And we're like sheep going astray, but now we've returned to the shepherd. And so the aspect of Jesus' death is brought into this picture. And it's interesting in this context of suffering unjustly and taking it patiently like Jesus. It's interesting now that he talks of other aspects of submission, including marriage. I can't help get that connection there. You know, we're going to talk about suffering, guys. And now let's jump on marriage. Marriage is good. God intended it for good. He said, when he made Adam in the garden, he said, it's not good that man should be alone. And Ecclesiastes 2 tells us two are better than one, and a threefold cord is not quickly broken. The Lord in the center, obviously. You know, and I think in many respects, we need to have that understanding of just how good marriage is. Well, because of the curse. After marriage was given, which was in chapter 2 of Genesis, chapter 3 then, we see the fall of man into sin. And after that point now, this institution that God intended to be beautiful and encouraging and a blessing can still be that, but it also takes a lot of work. In the same way that the curse upon man, that the ground would yield weeds and he'd have to work hard with the sweat of his brow in order to live. That which came just so naturally and easily with all the fruits in the garden now is going to be worked by the sweat of your brow. Well, that's true in marriage also. Marriage just doesn't happen. This emotional warm thing that is so great doesn't just happen. It's something that takes work and effort and self-denial and giving of oneself. You know, when I see the statistics in the world today, I realize that there are a great many people not wanting to put what it takes into a marriage. I think of the divorce rate, which it's estimated at 60% now in the world. And Christian divorces are growing also. There's a lot of people that, without natural affection anymore, their love is growing cold and lawlessness is increasing. You know, it's amazing, 2/3 of adults have had premarital sex, and only 8% have regretted it. Half of all adults under age 30 have lived with someone before they were married, and 70% of people in this country believe if you can't get along, it's better not to stay together, despite the children. 4 times the number of households have lived together before marriage than 20 years ago, and most in families today spend less time together, less dinner time, vacations are shorter, multiple TV sets have all hit the family. The family has taken a big hit. Some have real problems. Some have real difficulties. Some have minor problems, and yet the little things can sometimes be great irritants. You know, like which way you're going to put the toilet roll on or squeeze the toothpaste, you know, in the middle or at the end. Well, everybody knows you're supposed to do it at the end. I solved that problem. I've got a pump. But you know, the thing of it is, it's realize this. Marriage that God intended for good has taken a hit, and there are going to be difficulties. Well, in this context, even more so, because of the nature of the culture in the time that Peter was writing this. Women especially had it rough. That's why here, wives, or advice to wives, is 6 times the amount that given to husbands. I wonder why. No, actually, the reason is simple. The difficulty upon the women in those days was much greater than men. The women that came to the Lord and their husbands didn't come to the Lord, that could have been hell on earth. Where if a husband came to the Lord and his wife didn't, that was much easier because in that culture, the man basically had ownership of his wife. So, wife, you're coming to church. Simple. And so, with a wife coming to the Lord, it was difficult. She left the ancestral gods. Look out. In that culture, if she cooked the eggs wrong, that was legitimate grounds for divorce. If she was seen in public talking with a man, that would be legitimate grounds for divorce. I mean, it was very constrained. And much more if she would leave the ancestral gods of the Greeks or the Romans and follow Christianity, follow Jesus. That put a great strain upon relationships. And so the encouragement to women to know how to deal with this is much greater. Let's look at this because I want to see this from this standpoint. He says, likewise, you wives. Again, likewise brings us into the context of Jesus and his suffering patiently. And now he says, likewise, you wives. Be submissive to your own husbands that even if some do not obey the word, they, without a word, may be won by the conduct of their wives. When they observe your chaste conduct accompanied by fear. Now, Peter goes on to describe about this. And this aspect of submission, you know, why is it? This has to send us back to Genesis. The way that God intended it. God describes in Genesis chapter 2, and Peter and Paul both follow up on this, that man was created first, and man was given the authority by God. Man was made the stronger vessel. That's constitutionally different, but not the fact that he's superior. Rather, just he was made this way, to be the protector, the leader. A woman was made as a complement to the man, to make up deficiencies in him, to enable him to function in his God-given role. I look at this in a way, this from the very beginning, we see that women were given a subordinate role, but not in an inferior role. You see, there's a difference. Any type of leadership in general, and people have trouble with leadership in general anyway. People have trouble with authority and difficulties with authority all around the board. In an army, you've got one general. In a football team, you've got one quarterback. In a committee, you've got a chairman. Without leadership, without one person at least being the contact person, the one that's responsible ultimately, you go in different directions. You can't have two heads in a home. You need one head and one heart, and you've got a great balance. It doesn't mean, however, that the person that's given the headship of the home is the best person for the job. You see, the authority is there not to be in control as much as to use all available resources to go in the direction God has given. And this is, of course, coming back. We'll be looking at the husband's role the next time we get together on this subject because he'll deal with the husbands in verse 7. But the first six verses, he's setting the stage for women to deal in this rough situation that they're in. Here's a woman with a husband that's not obeying the word, perhaps. What does she do? In that culture, very limited possibilities. And so this is the encouragement. But I want you to see this. You see, though God has made the man responsible in the family, and honestly I feel it could very well be because man relinquished his leadership role in the garden. He followed his wife to sin. He followed her when she did wrong by taking of the fruit. She was deceived. He was willfully sinning. He knew exactly what he was doing. And so he was more culpable. He was more responsible. And I think it's very possible here that God has given man now a strong impetus to leadership because that's part of the failure he had in the garden. And part of the curse for the woman, it's interesting, in Genesis 3 it describes, is that you would try to usurp your husband's authority, but he would rule over you. The actual phrase says, your desire will be toward your husband, but he will dominate you. And that is a curse. In other words, a woman's temptation is to try to take control of that leadership role. And that's true. I mean, none of us want to be under authority. We chafe under it sometimes, and we have to learn. I know as a Christian, I mean, before I became a Christian, rebellion was my middle name. I mean, any authority I would challenge. I mean, I was one of those kids in school that I would just defy teachers. And they'd drag me down to the principal's by my ears, you know, most of the time. But I'd stand my ground, you know. I thought I was tough. I'm not going to listen. You know, our whole generation growing up that way, the hippie movement, you know, rebel against authority. And that's the tendency. But when we come to this, though that's her temptation, that the part of the curse is that man would dominate over her. And when you look at history, that's certainly proven true. Man has dominated over women. Now, that's not what God intended as a balance in relationship. That's part of the curse. Remember that. Leadership is a lot different than domination. You know, it's one of the things I have to learn. We all have to learn as men about that aspect of leadership. Leadership by example. Because submission is willingness. It's not forced. You can't have forced submission. He's saying, wives, be submissive to your own husbands. Be willingly subjective to them. That's what the phrase means. Be willingly subjective to them and giving them that preeminence, that opportunity to lead. That's a choice that women have to make, to be willing to do that. Do women have to, does my wife have to submit to me? If she was forced, it wouldn't be true submission by the nature of the word. However, how this works, increasingly men are relinquishing their role. When a husband doesn't take his role in the home, he fails to lead through either laziness or selfishness or whatever, leaving the discipline of the children to the wife, vacating his position. You've got, in many respects in our society, you've got man off, out earning a living, and the women are in charge of the home. And as the children grow, it becomes increasingly difficult. A man has to be present in some of those instances to lead and to take control, and many men relinquish that. They come home from work, and they want to sit in front of the TV, and they've worked all day, they've done their job, and now don't bother me. And you know when you do that? You're only consigning your family to an unscriptural position. Because then somebody's got to lead. I can't tell you how many times this happens. And yet here now I'm picking on the men. See, my wife always tells me that. I can start on a message on women, and I can start hammering the men. And yet I want to come back to this aspect of you know, submission. Now there are some extreme interpretations of this. One is that she has to be submissive unto her husband no matter what, absolutely obey her husband, and if there's any change that has to come to pass, it will has to only come through him. She cannot go against anything that he says, no matter what it is. That's an extreme view. Because if he says something wrong, for you to do something against God's will, you must obey God rather than men. I've seen some women who have felt that their position, and they've been taught by other women, that if their husband says, I don't want you going to church, that they have to stay home and pray for her husband to change. I think that's foolhardy, because now you're disobeying God in regard to another relationship. No, as long as your husband is asking you to do something that's right, fine. Willingly subject yourself to that. But if he's asking you to do something wrong, that's where it stops. You say, hey, later, Jack. Well, you want to say it a little nicer, but the point is, you know, you've got to follow the Lord. And certainly reading the Bible, getting fellowship, seeking the Lord in prayer, those are foundational. Now, the other extreme, however, and this, ladies, I want you to really hear out. It's maybe not even spoken, but it's practice. And that is, I'll submit to him as he follows the Lord. Well, your husband may not follow the Lord in some respects. Your husband may be in disobedience right now to the Lord. What are you going to do? Are you going to now set up shop in another place and do your own thing and forget him? He's of no account now. This is what Peter's saying. Wives, be submissive to your own husbands, that even if some do not obey the word, they, without a word, may be won by the conduct of their wives. See, here's an interesting thing. Here's where the power comes in. Notice what is expressed by Peter. He doesn't advise, when your husband's not obeying the word, to leave your husband. Doesn't say that. In fact, even Paul says there's, even with an unsaved husband, he commands that a wife should not leave her husband if he's not saved. I think it's interesting, because this is definitely a challenge when the very deepest thing in your heart now especially you ladies that have come to know the Lord, the deepest thing in your heart, if you can't share it with your husband, that is a lot of stress. That is difficult. You know, it's like not being able to share the most important thing on your heart, or they don't understand it. And that is a challenge. But the idea here is to remain. He's not saying to leave. He's also not saying to preach. He says, may without a word. You know, that's another thing. You know, you have a tendency to want to argue and fight and get your way in this. And that's not what he's called to do. You know, if your husband is not obeying the word and he's being disobedient and going in his own direction, and it may be even harming the family and hurting the relationship between you and him, what happens? Well, the most powerful thing that you can do is by your own example. And that's exactly what Jesus did. You see, you're following Jesus' footsteps. Don't you think it would have been pretty easy for him, Jesus, that is, to take charge when he was being unjustly treated? Don't you think he could have taken matters into his own hands and settled, you know, score with those guys that were putting him on the cross? Absolutely. But he didn't. And in a sense, we're called to follow that example. However, this is where it becomes very difficult. There's so many issues that can come involved in here. I mean, what about physical abuse in the home? Does the Lord expect a woman to stay in a home where she's being physically, and even in many cases, verbally abused? Only problem with verbal abuse is, boy, you can really stretch that one. But then there is some very real verbal abuse that can be very intolerant of, I mean, you can be have a real difficult time. Well, what does the Bible say about that? You know, it's interesting, the Bible does not spell out exactly what to do in those cases. And I think in those cases, you see, there has to be some common sense. You know, is there an absolute violation of the contract? Well, the Bible speaks about how a husband and wife should be together, and if there's adultery that comes into play, that's a breaking of that bond in the marital relationship. And that Jesus gives in Matthew and makes clear, except for the cause of unchastity, there should be no divorce. But obviously in that case where someone is being unfaithful, you know, what do? Do you let a man have his girlfriends on the side and yet you're now to submit unto him no matter what? You see, there you have to have common sense too. You know, there comes a time where you say, no, at this point, the marriage covenant has been so violated that there is no room. You know, I think a woman being physically abused needs to get out of that situation. Verbally abused to the extent that if she can't handle it, to get out for a time. And he has got to see whether it's a Christian marriage or non-Christian marriage, that certain things cannot be tolerated nor are tolerated by the state who, you know, gives us laws to protect us. So I think you have to use common sense in those. But in many, many cases, it's not a matter of extreme that we're dealing with, but a matter of discomfort, a matter of pride, a matter of issues that are not life-threatening. And here is where women are called to submit unto their husbands. And I'll tell you, here's a challenge. You may not look at your husband with respect. You may not respect him. Maybe he's not the leader at home. And so as you disrespect him, that comes out with an attitude. And you're going to get your way. You know, ladies, let me tell you something. You exercise far more power over your husbands than you realize. And many times I see men who are basically non-entities in the sense of leadership simply because the power in their home, it's a power struggle. And sometimes the men just don't even want to fight anymore. Just let her have her way. You see, ladies, you can win. That's what I'm saying. In many cases, you can win the battle, but lose the war. You can win the immediate, get your way in certain things, but have you really won? I think this is what it comes down to. Women, understand that in following the Lord's example, the first and foremost thing, you want to win your husband by your conduct. What is your conduct? Well, what did Jesus do? When they observe your chaste conduct, accompanied by fear, in other words, you're setting yourself apart. The word chaste there, when they observe your being set apart, your holy conduct, accompanied by fear. Why are you set apart unto the Lord? Because you see He is in charge. You're doing exactly what He says, in verse 23 what Jesus did. He committed himself to the, him who judges righteously. You're throwing all of your life into the Lord's hands and trusting the Lord to work out that situation in his time. In the meantime, you're honoring and respecting and submitting unto your husband. So this aspect of subordination, it's divinely willed. You know, the idea here is that it's a voluntary selflessness. It's kind of a yielding to one another. Think about the last argument you had with your husband. Think about the argument. I mean, think about how important that argument is in light of other things. Sometimes we argue over the silliest things. I remember Karen and I, you know, when we first got married, we used to get all the time just in this heated argument over making brownies. This is really funny. You know, because I liked a lot of frosting, and she didn't like any frosting. She thought I had enough calories already. And we always used to get in these arguments. We weren't smart enough just to frost half of the brownies. And I mean, it's like one of those things, you duh. Never thought of that. And we used to argue over this because it all came down to, you don't respect me. Well, you don't respect me, you know. And it was silly as I think back on it, you know. And one day I remember this. It's so funny because we were going to make brownies. And as we were making it, I thought I came up with a very noble suggestion. I said, you know, honey, let's not put any frosting in the brownies this time. She blew her mind. Because she said, you can't believe this, but I was ready to fight you and argue with you over the situation. And the Lord just spoke my heart to just pray. Lord, don't let him want to put frosting on it. And so I prayed instead of nagged you. And now you're telling me, let's not put frosting on it. And she was, you know what? She got so encouraged to pray for everything. See, it goes to show you, we men, we're not in charge as we think. Because our wives can pray. You see, ultimately, every husband is under the authority of the Lord. So if a wife understands that power, her power of influence and her true influence will be her conduct before the Lord and her trust in the Lord that he is going to work the situation out. And I love that. It comes right down to that. God working, intervening. When they observe your chaste conduct accompanied by fear. You know, we have a tendency to nag and to, you know, get our way. And I, you know, as a husband too, I mean, it's very easy for me just to yell about things. You know, it's just easy if I see something I don't like, just bleh, let it all fly out. And then afterwards the argument, and then afterwards the apology. And it's also unnecessary if we would just exercise a little self-control and turn a lot of our energy that we would think will get change if we force our way. I mean, that's what the world does. You know, it's change from intimidation. Who can intimidate the other person the most? Again, you win the battle, but you lose the war. You lose a whole lot more by winning those types of battles than you do in anything else. But when you are reasonable and you're yielded and you're willing to give in, I'll tell you, that's a powerful testimony. A very powerful testimony. I've seen men very convicted when their wives begin to change in this area. Now, let's put this in this culture, because a lot of times, if we take it out of the culture and the context in which it is, we'll try to apply it before we really are seeing what's being interpreted here. In that culture, women who are following the Lord now and their husbands are not, there's great stress and turmoil. Christians are being persecuted for following this sect called Christianity. And the Romans do not understand them. They serve the multitude of gods, and now these Christians are denying all those gods are real and are totally subverting the whole basis of the Roman system. And so therefore, you know, I mean, it was a pretty heavy thing. It would be like joining a cult in their eyes. You know, when a wife is in a situation, now what's going to really tell the truth more? Is it going to be her trying to get her way? Well, she would have been totally stamped out. But as she willingly subjects herself to her husband's authority and lives the Word of God, you know, there's now a heartfelt thing where what happened is, in those days, women were so subjugated that all they could do, the only thing really left to them, was look as beautiful as they could on the outside. And so that's all they had. And in luring men and being attractive. And of course, they could only do that from the context of the home in certain cultures, because they wouldn't even be allowed. They'd have to wear a veil. One of the writers of the Greek of that time said he divorced his wife because she didn't wear a veil out one time and showed her face to someone else. But all the woman had in that context, and from the time a woman was 14 years old in a marriageable age, that was her whole focus, look as beautiful as she could. So that was the culture. Well, now Peter's saying, hey, this is going to have more of an effect. And he goes on to say, don't let your beauty be that outward adorning or arranging of the hair or wearing of gold or putting on a fine apparel, but let it be the hidden person of the heart with the incorruptible ornament of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is very precious in the sight of God. Now, adornment. You see, the idea here, the word adorn, comes from the word cosmos, which we understand as order. So how are you going to order yourself is what the expression is. Well, we saw this in 1 Timothy, where women were encouraged to dress modestly, to adorn themselves in modest apparel. Well, that's literally to order themselves in ordered dress. Not with braided hair, not with costly jewels, etc., etc. Don't let your beauty be the outer adorning or arranging of the hair, wearing of gold, or putting on apparel. Now, is he saying that not to do these things at all? Some have interpreted this in that light. But the problem with that is it can't mean that, because in Song of Solomon, Solomon's bride is spoken of as comely with rows of jewels and around her neck chains of gold. So that can't be. Rebecca even was given gifts at her betrothal to Isaac along the lines of jewelry. So there's nothing wrong with jewelry. And there are people who take a fanatical position and take this verse out and they say, see, you're not supposed to be beautifying your hair or putting on makeup or, you know, doing anything to change your appearance to make it more beautiful, because that's carnal. That's not what Peter is saying here. But he's saying, don't let your beauty be that. Don't merely think that your beauty is those things. There's a greater beauty that you need to work on. The inner person, the hidden person of the heart. You know, it doesn't mean that you cannot take care of your appearance. I think makeup is a great thing. I think women look a lot better with makeup. If you can look better for your husband, then you should. You should not look plain if you can look better with makeup and adorning yourself. But don't let that be the main thing. You know, one man who was pretty tight with a dollar reluctantly agreed to let his long-suffering wife go shopping for a new dress. And as he went out the door, he told her if she was ever tempted to get a dress more than $100, she was to say, "Get thee behind me, Satan." So later she returned home. She was all happy and she showed him the dress. And he says, "Well, how much did you get it for?" She goes, "It was $250. Well, the man was pretty ticked off. She admitted when she tried the dress on that Satan whispered in her ear that it did look terrific. But then she remembered that the company dinner was only a few weeks away and she wanted to have it. And he said to her, "But didn't I tell you to say, 'Get thee behind me, Satan'?" She says, "Well, I did that." But Satan whispered again. He says, "It looks really good from the back, too." I thought that was funny. This does not mean, ladies, that you're not to be worried about what you're to wear and dress and this sort of thing, but don't let that be the main thing. This culture puts a high premium on beauty. And there are a great many women who that's all they can think about is how beautiful they look. Cosmetic surgery in this country has gone through the roof. People not satisfied with their appearance and doing artificial things, anything they can, but the problem is they're empty in other areas of their life. And this is what is encouraged for women. You see, there is a rare beauty that comes from the inner person. When I think of this, I think of the Proverbs 31 woman. She was not even in her submissiveness and respecting the authority of her husband, you see, a woman was a home manager. I mean, Proverbs 31, read that and tell me if you don't see woman's liberation. I mean, that in that culture was unheard of, a woman going out and buying a field and taking care of the affairs of the home and making business decisions. She has a lot of authority and a lot of leeway. But under her husband. He's ultimately responsible for the home and the family. But there's an inner beauty that comes out. He says, let it be the hidden person of the heart with an incorruptible ornament of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is very precious in the sight of God. You know, a woman can have a lot of influence with a gentle and a quiet spirit. A lot more than you'll ever get nagging and trying to force your husband to do this and do that and try to change him here and there. I mean, it's so funny when I think about this, because women that take the course of just continual nagging, Proverbs describe it as like a continual dripping, you know, it doesn't really get the effect. You kind of tune it out after a while. It's annoying, but you tune it out. But something amazing happens when there's a silence, and yet there's just that quietness and that meekness. And your prayers. Because you're throwing everything into the Lord's hand and you're trusting Him to work things out. He goes on in verse 5, he says, for in this manner in former times, the holy women who trusted in God also adorned themselves, being submissive to their own husbands. And Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord, whose daughters you are if you do good and are not afraid with any terror. In other words, Sarah was honored in that she recognized the authority of her husband. And even to the point of calling him master of the home, Lord. And he says, whose daughters you are if you do good and are not afraid with any terror. Remember, the curse is that your desire will be for your husband. The temptation you have as a woman is to take charge. Constantly take charge. And you want that control. And one of the first pieces of advice I can give to a man in a relationship of a husband and wife is to take charge. Do it firmly but gently. You've got to take charge. If you let your wife rule you, men, once you go down that road, it will not be good for either of you. She will quickly lose respect for you, and you will very quickly erode into an area that God has not called you to be. So that is an important thing. And at the same time, ladies, you know, men, there are some men that have more of a propensity to be strong and macho and leaders. You know, and if then you have a strong woman, you put the two together, that may fit, because a man is going to then, you know, take charge but come to that place. I mean, I would say, you know, Karen and I both are strong in our leadership. And so, I mean, that sweet little Armenian lady that I married, I mean, she, don't let her fool you. She's a tough cookie. She's a spark plug at times. And that's okay, because, you know, I'm not going to let her win just for the sake of that, but I'm not going to dominate either. You see, there is a balance. There's a real balance there. I'm going to be firm. I'm going to be like a tomato, firm but sweet. You know, I'm going to be firm in issues when it comes right down to it, but I give her a lot of leeway. But when I see things, you know, that we need to pull together on and go in a particular direction, you see, the ultimate responsibility, I mean, we have different roles. You know, I'm called to wear the pants in the family. My wife picks them out, but I wear them. We have different gifts and abilities. Now, here is where leadership becomes important. See, women may be much more gifted in a certain area than their husbands that have a lot to do with the running of a home. Well, does a husband feel like he's got to make all the decisions? No. He gives a lot of space. If his wife is good in a particular area, then let her run with it. As long as she is recognizing that the ultimate decision will come back on him. Why is that? Because that man is going to have to give an account to the Lord. He's going to be ultimately responsible. He's going to be ultimately responsible. I'm going to be ultimately responsible for my leadership in this fellowship before the Lord. I'm going to have to give an account to God for each of you for what has been entrusted to me. I will give an account to the Lord for that stewardship. So I want to make sure I'm not doing things to please men. I want to do things that are going to please the Lord, because ultimately I'm responsible to Him. Well, husbands, ultimately you're responsible to present your wives to the Lord. And how are you going to present them if you've relinquished your leadership? And ladies, how is that going to happen for you when you stand before the Lord and the Lord says, what did you do with the stewardship I gave to you? And you basically, all you can show him is that you took charge. Your husband wasn't leading, so you took charge. And instead of giving him the opportunity to lead. Because there may be some strong husbands, but there may be some weaker husbands that are real easygoing. And you can do basically get your way in whatever it is. Well, it's a greater temptation for you to do that. But you want to really listen closely of how you can be a support to Him, how you can be a blessing to Him. And there's this unique thing that happens. You see, husbands are called in Ephesians to love their wives as Jesus loved the church. Jesus died for the church. There wasn't any warm emotions going on there. That was tough love. He did what was best for them. And it cost Him. Husbands, are you willing to die to yourselves, what you want? As a leader, you're not in it for yourself. See, if a corporation, if a chairman of a corporation starts making decisions that only benefit him and not the corporation, that corporation is going to go bankrupt. In the same way, if a husband just makes decisions that are going to benefit him and not his whole family, and his wife is following along, is submissive in trusting the Lord to change him in those ways, you know, he's going to go through some suffering. He's going to go through some things. His wife might suffer with him. The whole family may suffer. But I can tell you one thing, you see, God makes incredible promises when it comes to marriage. Each of us have roles. And husbands are to love, wives are to submit. If agape love is practiced, if truly that giving of oneself for the benefit of the other is practiced, you have a great foundation for a relationship. A great foundation. I probably shared this story a number of times, that how I really learned. Before we were married, my wife certainly loved me with an agape love. When we went out to Hollywood Boulevard witnessing, and I was showing this other girl some of the things that we were doing. I was leading the group, so I was teaching different people, and this real pretty girl came and joined us, and I started spending more time with her, and then afterwards we got some coffee, and I sat with her instead of with Karen. And Karen and I were just friends at that point. There was real no relationship or commitment there, but we were close friends. Well, Karen saw this thing happen, this other pretty girl come in, and now I'm sitting with her and not with Karen. And at first she said, you know, it really was starting to bug her. Well, she began to rebuke herself, saying, Lord, forgive me for even thinking that. I don't have any claim on him. I want the best for him. And if that woman would be better for him as a wife than me, then I pray that you give her to him. You know, she didn't tell me this. Later, after we were married, she told me this. And it kind of blew my mind, because, hey, that is agape love. Wanting the best for the other. And when the husbands are doing this and the wives are doing this, you see what happens? You're both looking out for each other's interests. How can you do that? Husbands, you better lead. You better lead and take that responsibility to lead. Wives, take that responsibility to back up your husband's play. To give him the preeminence in that. Even in the same way as Paul tells us, the ladies should submit themselves under their husbands as unto the Lord, giving him that place. And you've got an outstanding relationship. Problem is, who's going to fulfill their role first? Well, I'll submit to him if he starts leading like he should. Well, I'll start leading if she starts submitting to me. You know, who's going to start? I submit to you that the winner will be the one who yields to their God-given role first. And does what God has called them to do. Now, in leadership, husbands have unique challenges, and we're going to be talking about that next time. But there are a lot of problems that can happen in marriage. There's a lot of things that can come in. This is not going to answer many of the hard issues that some of you are facing in this culture and in this time. And I think any time you go through some things that really stretch you to the limits, it's always wise to seek out the counsel of those godly people who have gone before. One of the reasons we like to see young couples getting, as they're starting to think about marriage, to let the church know that you want to get in a premarital class. Our premarital class is not a formal thing where you sit down behind a desk, you know, in a chair, and you hear all this information, you know, regurgitated out to you that you're supposed to memorize. What it is that there are more mature couples in the body that have proven their walk and their marriage before the Lord, and you get together. A couple that's thinking about getting together gets together with this couple, and they just get mentored. They spend time, yes, going through scriptures. There's homework involved, but there's more of a relationship going on. It's both husband and wife, or ministering to husband and wife, or husband and wife-to-be. And that's a real special time. And in some cases, there are times when couples are really struggling or young in their marriage, and they have now that mentor that they can continue to go to. I encourage that strongly. I think the best counsel you'll ever get in marriage is from those who have walked in a good marriage and followed the Lord, because it hasn't been easy and it hasn't been perfect. And they've had to learn the hard way too. But they can tell you what works. They can show you how it works and how the Lord has designed it. And it's a powerful testimony. Again, you know, someone maybe who have just come in and joined our study and wondering, well, how does all this fit? I mean, my life, I mean, this is so new. I've never heard anything like this. It sounds so unique and so different. I think, honestly, if you search your heart, it rings true because it's how God created it. But never think that any role that we have here on earth has any bearing at all with our equality. In fact, that's what we'll be looking at next time, as husbands who make the mistake of thinking that because they're the stronger vessel and they're the leader, that they don't grant their wife as an equal heir of the grace of life. And that's a mistake that they make, and we'll be looking at that next time. Realize that this is not about equality, because the Bible says there's neither Jew nor Greek, male nor female, but we're all one in Christ. I played a mean joke on my wife before we got married, and I have to share this with you, because it was one of those things where it just kind of shows that submission is not just laying yourself down and becoming a doormat. But I remember telling her, honey, what the Bible says about me being the head of the home and you submitting to me is that in heaven, when we get to heaven, actually there's not going to be like you and I. We'll just be like one person, and I'll be the head and you'll be the rest. And she looked at me with those big eyes and said, really? You know, oh, that doesn't sound so fun. I had to laugh at that. That was a cruel joke. But that is what sometimes people think in terms of headship. They think dominant. They think, you know, inferior. And that's not what it is at all. It's a beautiful relationship. But I'll tell you, when you hear on the sitcoms and you hear in the newspapers, you hear all these other things about it being a 50-50 relationship, I'll tell you, those who go into a relationship marriage 50-50 do not survive. Because it's not a 50-50 relationship, folks. It's a 100-100 relationship. It's each person giving 100% to obey what God has given them as their role. And when each person is giving 100%, you have an awesome thing. See, because if you start giving 50, you're going to give actually 30 thinking you've given 50. And this person's going to give 30 thinking they're giving. There's going to be a big gap in there. And you'll be resentful. You'll be angry at your partner because they're not meeting you halfway. Well, there's no such thing. You guys have to be willing to go the distance. You have to be willing to go 100%. That's why the vows, till death do us part, in adversity and prosperity, to cleave unto him or her as long as we both shall live. And there is that commitment there, that despite whatever happens in sickness and in health, in difficulties, in blessings, you're willing to go the distance. And that's an outstanding relationship. Now, how this all ties in with the example set before us with the Lord is that God saw us in our rebellion. And we were going our own way. And how he chose to bring us back to his fold was not through this demonstration of power by dominating us, by forcing us. He could have twisted us around so fast and made us follow him. But there's no real relationship there. He came and he submitted himself unto the Lord's will, his Father's will, even though it meant submitting himself unto death. And the Lord exalted him and honored him above all. The name of Jesus Christ, every knee will bow, and every tongue will confess, he is Lord. That's the example the Lord set for us. You see, power, through the seeming loss at the cross, he won. But the world seems to think that you lose when you give in. But in the Lord's kingdom, in his economy, when you submit yourself unto his will, he honors you and he works way beyond what you could have ever accomplished in your own ability and your own strength. So the challenge for each person is to come to that place of submitting unto the will of the Lord. Husbands to lead, get off your duff and take that leadership position God has called you to take. And wives, to submit unto your husbands, even when they don't obey the Lord, you submit unto them, giving them that space and that preeminence, giving them the opportunity to lead, and you see some dynamic things happen. One example I want to leave on you with this is, oftentimes, when you have an unsaved situation with a wife with an unsaved husband, and she's growing in the Lord and learning a lot of things spiritually, she'll come around the fellowship and she'll meet some people, and she's meeting some good sisters that are giving her some guidance, and she's meeting some brothers in the church too. You have to be careful, because you see, she's wondering just what a Christian man would be like. And she begins looking at these Christian men and think, oh man, my husband, he doesn't know anything spiritually. And so she begins asking these other Christian men questions about the scriptures. And oftentimes, I see this, you know, where a man is counseling a married woman, and their husband isn't even in the church, and he's given her wisdom and counsel, and very easily she begins to, you know, take all this, they're pouring their treasure into each other, and then they fall into a relationship. Very dangerous. What does the Bible say? I think the Bible gives us clear thought. A wife, if she has that, she should go back to her husband and say, you know what, I was wondering about Acts chapter 4, verse whatever. You know, could you help me out with this? Now, he doesn't have a clue what it is. But by the very fact that she has asked him, you see, something may click in his mind. Maybe I should learn a few things here. Because oftentimes a man who doesn't know the Lord and his wife does, and she starts growing in the Lord, he looks at himself and he thinks, man, I could never become a Christian now because she's so far ahead of me. You know, and there's that pride and that ego that gets in. Or sometimes, you know, she'll go and she'll get all of her questions answered with the men at the church, the pastors or counselors of the church, and she'll go home and she's got no questions for him at all, and she's got her relationships out there. And in a way, he feels spiritually castrated. He has no authority anymore. And he feels useless in that area of her life. I find that when women would go home with some of their questions, and not to try to preach to him and cajole him into the scriptures, but rather, honestly, you know, just be yourself, saying, you know, I was reading in 1 Peter and I saw this, and I'm just wondering, what do you think about that? And make him do his own study. Let him have that leadership role. And if he doesn't take it, well, at least you've given him that opportunity. Now, who can tell what the Lord might use as you just present it to the Lord and say, Lord, here am I.